Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
You know, I joke right now that the ACC that you see today, that ain't the damn, that's not the real ACC. You know, it is not. I get it, it's different eras, man. But during that time, I mean, every single night that I played, I was playing against a dude that ended up being, you know, an NBA player, you know, whether it be Randolph Childress, Stephon Marbury, you know, Bobby Hurley, man, Chris Whitney at Clemson, who was very underrated, Travis Best at Georgia Tech. You know, you had to bring your hard hat every game. And I joke with people, I'm like, there's no way in hell during that time that there would be a trend. This is no disrespect, but there's no way in hell that there would be a transfer from, you know, Radford or Loyola that was going to come and transfer to an ACC school and start and be like a first team all league guy. Like, that wasn't happening.
Welcome back to another episode, Not Even D2. I'm your host, KJ Allison, here with my boy and co-host, Naruto Perdomo. We got a great episode for you guys today where we talk with Dwayne Simpkins, former DMV legend, McDonald's All-American. Was really like that during his playing career. And now he's coaching American University, playing in the Patriot League. Just had a really successful year in the Patriot League where they won the championship and they made it to the NCAA tournament. So really, really good coach, really good player. We talk about a lot, but I want to talk NBA first, bro. I'm a Thunder fan. I might need to pull up the picture. I don't know if you got time for me to search for it, but I'm an OG Thunder fan. Everybody that knows me knows I go hard for the Thunder. They just won a chip, so I'm ecstatic right now. I feel like I just won the chip, but I just want to hear your thoughts before I talk a little bit more about the Thunder. But you can't, I respect it. Like, that's tough, but you can't be jacking the Thunder just because a KD guy.
I definitely used to be a KD guy back in the day until he went to the Warriors, and that hurt my heart. So I had to stop rooting for the Thunder after that. But it was a great series for basketball, bro. You know, you always love game seven and, you know, sneak peek for the fans. We're going to have more of an in-depth conversation about it soon, but definitely, you know, a great series. It was just a great playoffs overall, great cap on the season, bro. A lot of people talking down about how the viewership is down, how basketball, you know, this era of basketball isn't good. But in my opinion, this is one of the best playoffs that I can remember. There were a bunch of game winners, crazy moments, crazy storylines. And, you know, definitely the Thunder were really the best team all season. And people were kind of overthinking it, I think. But, you know, definitely congrats to the Thunder. Congrats to you. Congrats to Zay. You know, my boys, they but definitely great series of basketball for sure, bro.
Yeah, when we did the initial like first round playoff prediction, I remember you said that this is like the most unpredictable playoffs, and this was just in the first round, and it got way crazier throughout each series. And one thing about game seven, Tyrese got hurt. You never, like a competitor or a fan, you never want to see a team's best player get hurt. Like, people talking about asterisk next to the Thunder's championship, which I don't agree, but either way, like, seeing Tyrese go down definitely was like, damn, now it's going to be that instead of just the basketball. But a little bit about game, we don't even have to talk too much about game seven, but it was special seeing the defense like be the reason that they won the final game. It was like historically good throughout all year, so to see them buckle down in the last second half and be like, yo, you guys can't do anything with us. TJ went on that run. I was like, yo, Rudy's gonna have his way with me. But it was a great series, bro. And like you said, we got more coming. on NBA. Probably drop that next week. So definitely stay tuned. Subscribe, like, all that.
Bro has seven turnovers, so I can't even really say no.
Facts, he was giving us the ball a little bit. But let's talk about today's episode with Dwayne Sipkins, bro, because I just mentioned a little bit about him, but he's just like a really good coach. This is his second year, and he already made it to the NCAA tournament. Like, not many coaches can do that. And there's a lot of factors that go into this, whether it's, you know, coaching under some really good coaches, which we talk about, a lot of experiences. But I was looking at his Twitter, bro, and he's like saying happy, like shouting out dudes on their birthday, saying he loves them, shouting out when they get an internship. It's stuff like that, that it's not even just the basketball stuff, but it really makes it feel like a family atmosphere. I was listening to him talk about how he's very communicative with the parent or the players' parents. So throughout the off seasons, he'll talk to their parents about, you know, relationships or their grades, their school, their summer, anything like that. So it's clear to see why they've had one transfer in the past 2 years. And I'm definitely excited to see where he takes American University basketball, but also the trajectory of his career keep rising up.
100%, bro. It was definitely a great conversation with Coach Sipkins. You know, I was really excited to talk to him, you know, just hearing him talk on other platforms, you know, about, you know, his journey. And it was a great conversation with him. Obviously, you mentioned he's a great coach, but he's a great person overall, like you mentioned, shouting people out. And his story is relatively unconventional with getting into coaching, right? Like, he kind of, I think he may have said it in an episode, but most people would assume, like, you're a McDonald's All-American, you played high major basketball. Like, as soon as you get out of college, all these coaches and schools are going to be calling for you and asking you to come be on the staff. But he really had to grind his way onto the scene, and it's well deserved what he's doing now. I mean, like you mentioned, Patriot League championship in your second year of coaching. You know what I'm saying? He has a great resume already as a young coach. So I'm really excited, like you said, to see the trajectory of his career, but also the trajectory of American basketball too.
Nah, facts. And to talk more about the basketball, which we talked about in the episode too, but I imagine that players are just so hyped to play under. Like, a player like you would definitely love playing with Sipkins. He was saying if like the defense isn't covering you at the 3-point line, like, you got the green light to shoot it. It doesn't matter if there's 30 seconds left on the shot clock or one. That's a good shot for us. So I know that shooters love to play with him, but especially like a point guard like me, you just get the ball and you're out. You don't have to think about what does coach want me to run. Like, let's just get into instant offense. So, like, Coach Sipkins really, and this is another reason why former players are, I shouldn't say better coaches, but they at least have, you know, some advantages in the coaching realm because they understand how it is to play basketball. Like, what's fun? What do players enjoy? Stuff like that. So this is a really good episode. We talked about a lot with Coach Sipkins regarding his crazy basketball career, you know, growing up in the DMV, talk about Len Bias situation. This is just a great episode. Coach Sipkins funny too. So definitely stay tuned for everything we got in store. Subscribe, like, go follow us at Not Even D2. And let's hear from Coach Sipkins. All right, we are here with our guy, Dwayne Sipkins. How you doing today, Coach?
Doing great, man. Appreciate you guys having me on.
For sure. Definitely appreciate you getting on, Coach. You know, we like starting these episodes with a little bit of small talk. So KJ and I was wondering, how have your offseason changed since, you know, you're becoming a head coach? Because you were an assistant for a long time at the college level too.
Yeah, off seasons, you know, for me as a head coach, the biggest difference between being an assistant coach and a head coach, like, right away, you start to look at what you have coming back in terms of personnel, and what you have coming in with new, you know, freshmen, what have you. And then you go back kind of and you look at the preceding year and what went well, what didn't go well. You know, when you guys, just before I hop on the podcast with you guys, I'm actually going through some, it's probably day three or day four of just going through and watching all of our games from last year, wins, losses, and just making notes of things that we did well, things we want to kind of build on, and then the things that we didn't do well as a team, me as a coach, you know, it could be, I was just watching our game against UVA Sunday night, and then last night I watched the high, which game was it? It was our Navy game. And both of those games, there was a period of time where, like, there was not a foul call. There wasn't a dead ball infraction, and it was a long period. UVA game, we were up 5 points with less than 4 minutes to go. And we had one of our players, Colin Smalls, just graduated. He made 2 threes. He had it going. And we had gone up and down, offense, defense, and I proceeded to run 2 or 3 quick hitters for him. And it was obvious from watching the film afterwards that he was tired. Like, I had no business running those plays for him. If I was going to do that, this is the lesson I learned. If you are going to do that, call a timeout, let those guys get a breather, and then try to come back and do it. And then the Navy game, we actually went through 2 media timeouts. Like, we went a long time, and you know, I got stuck in my ways. It was a carryover from the UVA game. In my mind, I'm like, we're tougher than them. We're tougher than them. And we weren't at that point in time. You know, Navy punched us in the mouth, and I should have called a timeout. And I look back at it critically, and I was like, we didn't lose the game because of that, but that definitely it hurt us. It didn't help us at all. So just doing things like that, man, and trying to learn the game within the game, different things that I can work on as a coach to help put my guys in the best position to be successful.
Yeah, it's crazy that we call it the off season, and the off season is usually the season where you're putting the most work in. Got to watch film, got to get in the portal, got to talk to guys about what they're looking for in NIL or whatever collective they're in. So it definitely gets hectic, but talking more about the film aspect, we were talking to Coach Merkel. He's the head coach at Randolph-Macon College right now. And he was saying,
Great guy.
But he was saying that when he's watching a game, he often tells guys, when you see a lot, you're actually seeing a little. So I'm curious, like, what are you specifically looking at when you're looking in the film? You could be just saying full game stuff, or are you looking at ATOs? Or, like, just talk to me about your film process.
Yeah, everything. I'm looking at our transition defense. I'm looking at our half-court defense and ball screen coverage. And are guys zoned up properly at their positioning on a baseline drive? What do our rotations look like offensively? You know, just looking at small things, you know, the footwork of our big men. If we're going to twist a screen, are they executing it properly? Are they rolling hard? So not necessarily looking at, like, this specific play or that specific play, but things that are going to be, you know, these things are going to carry over from year to year. Those things don't change, not within our system. So that's what I'm really focused on when I'm watching this stuff at this time of year.
I wanted to speak a little bit more on the film aspect of it, Coach. So, you know, I have access to a Synergy account, and, like, you know, you could see like the points per possession, right? Or, like, where you may rank in certain, like, against man, against zone, in transition. Yeah, obviously you may know. And I saw online that in after timeout situations, you guys are, like, 89th percentile in the country, and just in terms of execution. And watching some of the ATOs, like, you guys run some really good shit. I'm not going to lie. Like,
man, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, like, how you develop your plays, really.
It starts and ends with the players, quite honestly. You know, we got to take a deep look at, you know, our personnel. You know, Matt Rogers, for instance. Matt was arguably the best player in our league last year. You know, he's a pick and pop 4-5 man. As good as he was not nearly as effective on the right block as he was on the left. So knowing, A, our personnel, the things that they do well, and then, 2, really taking a deep dive into the opposing team. And what do they do, say, on baseline out of bounds or sideline out of bounds? And you know, we have, you know, sideline out of bounds, baseline out of bounds. We may have, I don't know, 15, 20 plays. And going into that particular game, you know, probably 3/4 of our plays for sideline out of bounds and baseline out of bounds it doesn't fit. But there may be 5 or 6 plays that we say we're going to hone in on these going into this particular game, and we think we're going to get some good stuff of this off of this. Like, hey, some team may, they may switch everything on baseline out of bounds. Some teams may have, you know, a 2-3 zone that they're going to play. And so going into that particular game, we kind of pare down all the things that we have into what is going to work for that specific team.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, it seems like a lot of your program and who you are just early on talking to you is about preparation. So I'm wondering this, you know, you guys had 22 wins, 13 conference wins, which is tied a program record, and the first NCAA tournament appearance in over a decade. So first, what did the preparation look like for this group? But also, when did you realize that this team was different?
I really felt, quite honestly, that the first year that I got the job, I felt we had enough pieces in place. I thought we had an interior guy who, you know, could be really good inside. He had shown that he could shoot. He just didn't shoot a lot from three. I felt that we could increase Matt Rogers' three-point attempts and continue to help him be consistent and efficient from that area. I thought we could be good. I thought Elijah Stevens was a really good point guard. He had to get his turnover rate down. And I felt that we had enough adequate shooters to kind of play five out if we needed to. And then if we wanted to go four out, one in, and Matt in the middle, that we could do that. I really felt from year one that we had the pieces. Mm-hmm. A lot had to go our way, and it didn't, quite honestly. Even though we finished second that year, I really felt that we could have finished first and we could have won the league had we stayed healthy. So being able to retain that group from year one to year two, it started with that. Those guys knew our system. We weren't starting from scratch like we were from in year one. And I felt that our level of maturity, it had taken a step in last summer. You could kind of see it. And we still had a long way to go. But the biggest test was going to be if we could still be, you know, resilient and together through a tough non-conference slate that we were going to have. And we wanted to make it tough. You know, and I didn't want our guys to get too discouraged. I didn't harp on it and say, hey, man, we could go to Carolina and lose by 50. You know, we left from there and went and played High Point. We went to St. Joe's and played. Like, those are some tough games against some really good coaches and really good teams. Yeah. But we came out of that in a non-conference. I think we were 7-6. And that was really good, you know. So I think when I saw us come out of that non-conference, and for us to kind of still have the togetherness, I thought we had a really, really good chance.
Yeah. I mean, you guys had a really good year this year. And I want to specifically talk about the Patriot League tourney this year. You guys hosted. It was the first time you hosted the chip game since 2009. And I was watching the film from that game, and the game was packed. Like, it probably was sold out. I didn't see the numbers or anything, but there was not many seats open. It was very loud just based off the film. And I was reading some things that you guys led the Patriot League in, like, home game attendance. Your home versus away splits are very drastic. You got your record especially. So I'm just kind of curious if you could talk about, one, the Patriot League being able to host it at American, but also the fan support throughout the year and how much that kind of propelled you guys towards the end of the year.
Yeah. We got fortunate. We were guaranteed to host the quarterfinal game against Lafayette. We won that game by 2 points. Lafayette, really, really, really well coached team. We were very, very fortunate to win that game. And then we were going to face Colgate for the semifinals. And we were fortunate to win that game. And we, because of the way the tiebreaker broke down, which, you know, I absolutely hate, but it is what it is. But, you know, we were in first place the vast majority of conference play. And, you know, we lost a couple down the stretch and we ended up tied with Bucknell. And the way that they did the tiebreaker for the playoffs, it had it so that Colgate actually got the number one seed. And so the semifinal game for us obviously was against Colgate. And on the other side, Navy had to go to Bucknell. And Bucknell got upset by Navy. And, you know, consequently, we ended up getting to host the championship game. So that was not how we drew it up, but it was cool the way that it worked out. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the attendance and Bender, man, like, our our fans were just fantastic. You know, they got excited when we had a stretch of games where I think we won, I don't know, 7 or 8 in a row. And you can kind of feel the momentum building and getting more people in the gym. And we had to do some stuff ourselves. You know, we, I don't know how many more donuts I could pass out and how many more pizzas I could pass out and coffee and everything else, man. But that's part of the job. Like, you want to get people excited about what you're doing. Yeah, it's winning games definitely helps, but I think that we develop a connection with the student body in particular, that they knew who we were, you know, as a staff. They knew who we were as players. You know, one of the big rules that I have with our players, man, is when, you know, we got 4 core values, and our 4th one, it's not the least important one, but it comes last, is humility. And when you walk across campus, you're not the big bag basketball player that's on scholarship. You know, those people, those students want to see that you're human. They want to see that you can interact with them and smile and joke and everything. And I think our guys did a tremendous job of making themselves available and showing that humility. And I think all of those things combined made it so that people felt like, hey, there's a personal connection and I want to come out and support. And, you know, it didn't hurt that my wife and my wife's family and my family from the DC area, and we got big family, so they came out to support as well.
Now I know that fam support is always big time, but at one point I wanted to talk about was that when Kelvin Sampson first got hired at Houston, he was walking around the campus and like handing out.
I saw that on X, man. That was awesome. When I saw that, I was like, yo, if Kelvin Sampson can do it, I sure as hell can do it. Like, that dude, I think he's the best coach in college basketball, personally. Hurley's really good, and Izzo and those guys. But, man, like, what Kelvin Sampson has done, and that video, it showed it all, man. Like, there was nobody coming to the games. I mean, he literally had to go, like, classroom to classroom to introduce himself and everything. And here you are X amount of years later. I mean, the dude's going to Final Fours and knocking on the door of a national championship. So if Kelvin Sampson can do it, we sure as hell any other coach in America can do it.
Hell yeah. I mean, another big part of why I think Americans starting to support is watching you guys play, like your team's play is kind of electric. And I know you're big on like the pace. You guys are like 7 seconds or less. If we can get a shot up, I like that for our offense. So I'm kind of curious, like looking at some of the statistics, you guys broke a program record for 3-pointers made, and that's modern basketball, but it's not American, like what they were used to. So as a new head coach, like were you confident going into that? Like, this is my style. Where did you kind of develop this 7 seconds or less, or like imploring guys to take these, you know, early shots that might not be looked at to many coaches at good shots?
Yeah, I credit Kim English. You know, my 2 years of working with Kim and George Mason, man, like I was exposed to that. That's how I like to play, but I didn't have necessarily a term for it and everything. And, you know, watching, you know, being in that in that program with Kim and in the film room and coaches room and talking about it and seeing what it looked like. You know, quite honestly, it's no different, man, than when you watch the NBA, because there is such a short shot clock and people fail to realize there's a huge difference between 30 seconds and 24. Huge. Doesn't seem like a lot, but when I made the transition from playing in college to playing professionally in Europe, I mean, that 4 seconds, is, I mean, 6 seconds is different. It's big. It's a big difference. So anytime you're able to get the ball out, man, after, you know, we didn't do it as much this past 2 years. We will do it more this year in terms of taking the ball out of the net after a miss, after a make, and still pushing. But especially on turnovers and rebounds, we wanted to push tempo, man, because that's the most vulnerable time for the defense. You know, the hardest thing to teach, I think, defensively is transition defense, you know, because, you know, not everybody wants to, you know, win the first 3 steps and sprint and talk and point. Like, it's the most vulnerable time. So, you know, it's funny, our numbers, if you were to look at KenPom, it shows that we're one of the more deliberate teams in college basketball, but it's somewhat, it's kind of a misperception to some degree. We want to push, and we will push it. You know, we get a steal, we get a miss, we're going to push it. But if we don't get what we want, we're going to turn you over, go take you from side to side, and we want to get the shot that we want, the shots that we value.
I was listening to you talk on basketball immersion earlier, and I like that, how if you don't have it, you have certain triggers, like a DHO to get the big to lift or something. So that makes your offense super dynamic because it's kind of like the Pacers. If they don't have the initial hit ahead, get to something, they have second side options and their ghost ball screen, stuff like that. So I could definitely see why you guys are playing offense at a high level. But I was looking through the schedule for next year. You got the non-conference posted and you playing Virginia, Rutgers, and Wake Forest. So those are high
major schools. And VCU.
Yeah, I was going to say, and 2A-10 schools. So I'm not sure if this is true, but how did kind of like the scheduling change since you won the Patriot League, you made it to the tournament, or was it like this is going to be our schedule no matter what?
Yeah, we had already started to work on it, quite honestly, well before, you know, going to the tournament. We were just going to hope that teams didn't want to back out because it's coaches are crazy, man, in college. They see a team that went to the tournament the year before, and it's like, oh, we don't want to play you. I'm like, it's the dumbest thing. Like, everybody's roster's turning over every year. If you're a Power Four school, like, if you're concerned about playing American, like, you got bigger problems. You know what I mean? but for us, the biggest thing was, you know, we're going to host the MTE this year, multi-team event. It's the first time that we've ever done it. And, you know, getting that locked in was really important to us. And, you know, we're proud that we're going to be able to host it here in D.C. And, you know, Siena's going to come down. Longwood's going to be here. And Maine, who's, you know, he's done a hell of a job there. So we're looking forward to that. But, yeah, man, the non-conference, it was – I didn't want to play Carolina again. but you know, we try to be strategic with our non-conference schedule, in particular the bye games. You know, the idea is that you get, you know, the bye games help supplement your operating budget. You know, our budget's pretty lean, so we got to bring in some money to offset some of the costs that we have. And it just doesn't make sense to me when, yeah, we could go play Texas or we could go play UCLA, but, you know, they cut a check for 85, 90 grand and we're spending another 30 between flights and hotels. Like, we might as well go play an A-10 team. And we're geographically positioned where we can drive to a number of Power Four schools and kind of cut down on costs like that. So, you know, we wanted to, you know, play some A-10 teams. Those checks aren't as big. But at the same time, I think it was good that we could drive down to Wake Forest. You know, we can drive up to Rutgers. We can make the hour and 45-minute drive to VCU. So all of those were really, really important for us.
Nah, KJ and I might have to come through to that MTE next year. I'm not going to lie. We might have to
come on through, man. Come on through. Bring some people with you.
Let's do it. I wanted to bring this point up because I had talked about it with Coach Scary. Shout out Coach Scary, head coach at Towson University. But
my guy.
Yes, sir. But we had mentioned how, like, there's a bunch of schools in the DMV. And, you know, I asked him, how does he want to stand out among those other schools? So I probably should ask you the same thing because American's right in the DMV. So how do you want to stand out, you know, compared to the other schools?
Before you answer, Coach, I just want you to know, Coach Scary started talking crazy. He was like, well, we got the best winning percentage in the DMV.
He did say that.
I don't know. He's got to talk. Well, after this year, maybe it's different. But coming into this year, Howard University, my guy Kenny Blakeney, he could stake that claim. You know, I think he had went to two consecutive NCAA tournaments or whatever it is. So, yeah, he could have an argument against that. You know, for us, man, it's you know, one, I want people to see that we play hard, we play connected. I want them to recognize that in this day and age of transfer portal, you know, we've had one transfer in 2 years. So I think that speaks to our culture. I think this speaks to us being been fortunate as well. We've had guys that have got 2 feet into this program and they value the AU education. And I know I get it. You know, the money is good and everything, but if you haven't made that kind of money, if you haven't made a lot of money, like some of the money that some guys are being offered from our level to the next level up or two levels up, sometimes it's not life-changing money. It may seem like a lot at that point in time. But when you pay taxes and you pay your attorney and you pay, you know, the accountant and you pay your agent if you have one, like, what are you really making? And my biggest fear and concern for some of these guys, man, 2, 3, 4 years from now, hell, 5, 10 years from now, when the ball does stop bouncing, what's your network? Like, who are you picking up the phone with to say, hey, man, I've got this great business idea. I want to run it past you because I want to try to, you know, get some investment money. A lot of these guys, they won't have a quote unquote network that they can go back to. But that's the biggest thing, man. I want people to recognize that we play hard, we play connected, we treat our guys right, we're firm but fair, and you know, we want to develop our guys holistically on and off the court.
I mean, you know, Patriot League is known for the high academic, you know, for it being a high academic league, like a sidestep to the Ivy League, some would say, just in terms of some of the many, you know, great schools in the conference. Well, one thing about the NIL point that you're bringing up, Coach Fran Brown, Syracuse football coach, I'm pretty sure he said in an interview, he was like, I ain't paying no seven figures unless it's for that boy Travis Hunter. You know, so it's like, he's not like, yeah, like it's good money, but you're like you're saying, it's not, he's not going to give life-changing money to every, you know, prospect that, you know, comes to on the table. So definitely making up some great points, Coach. But I want to talk more about this DMV area, because you're from the DMV, and that's one of the most talent-rich area regions in the country, right? A lot of, you know, NBA players in the area. You were a, you know, McDonald's All-American yourself. You know, one of the top, played at DeMatha Catholic, under the legendary coach Morgan Wooden. Is that how you say his last name? Wooden?
Wooden. Yeah.
Wooden. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Morgan Wooden. So first, just talk about your memories growing up in the DMV against, you know, playing against top talent, but also how you feel like your environment shaped who you are today.
Yeah. You know, I may be biased. I know I am biased, but I think that the DC area per capita is the most talent-rich basketball area in the country. You know, people may say, well, California's got pros and Texas got pros. I'm like, yeah, those places are like damn 10 times the size of the DC area, you know. But per capita, you won't find many places that are like the DMV. I tell people all the time, like when I was working in UNC Greensboro some years ago, and Carolina's got, they got a rich tradition and rich talent and everything. But it's kind of spread out. And at the time, I mean, I think it's still to this day, there was no shot clock. And because it was so spread out, I would go see a kid play that's a good player, and he's not really playing against anybody, you know, and they don't have a shot clock, and both teams are sitting back in a zone, and I'm trying to do an evaluation of like, damn, can this kid play? Can he guard the ball? Can he play ball screen defense? Yeah. You know, but here we got a shot clock. I think that other areas have really good coaches. Don't get me wrong, but I think from the high school level to AAU, we have a lot of really good coaches that know what they're doing. And it's not just talent acquisition. I mean, truly working with guys and getting them better year in, year out. And then the competition, man, I think because we have those guys that are the blue chippers, and we got those guys who are potential mid-major, you know, talents, and those slightly beneath them. And they all compete against each other from the time that they're 8, 9, 10 years old through high school. And the ones at the bottom are looking at the ones above them and like, hey, I got to go catch him. And the ones there are looking at the ones above them. So it creates this competition, man. It was, you know, iron sharpens iron. You know, they're playing pickup together. They're competing against each other in AAU. They're competing against each other in high school. And I just think over a period of time, those guys are competitive. They're tough. They've been well coached. And I'd be willing to say this, if you were to go and look at a number of areas, metropolitan areas, the guys that come from the DC area, even if they were the sixth man at DeMatha or Bishop McNamara or the seventh man, those guys, because they have gone through the fire competition and they've been well coached, when they do transition to college, they are much further along than most of their peers that are coming in as freshmen. So, you know, all those things, man, have made it so that that's who I am. You know, the DNA is competitive. You know, you play with a chip on your shoulder. No matter if you are a McDonald's All-American, like I had dudes going at my head because you know, we go play pickup ball on a Saturday morning. They're like, well, this is Dwayne Simpkins. He's supposed to be good. I'm going at him. And it made me raise my game up, you know. So that's the DMV.
Word. No, that's great how you put it like that. And I could see that firsthand. I say this a lot, but you could see it, especially in like DMV players. It don't matter if you're a 5-star, like if you're on the same court as them, they don't care. Like that competitive just gonna come out, and it's you bleed the same way I bleed, so it could up for you. But you mentioned Coach Blakeney, and I was trying to find your actual high school team's roster. I couldn't find it. Was he on you? Did you guys play together?
We did. We played we played 2 years together.
Words.
Played 2 years together. He was my sophomore. I played with him for 3 years because I made varsity as a freshman. And we lost in a city title game his senior year. I actually had the flu. I played like half the first quarter and I couldn't play. We lost by one to Dunbar, D.C. And then he went to Duke. And the next year we ended up playing Dunbar again and we won. But Kenny and I go way back, man. After school, if we had a game that day, I would actually hop in his car and go back home with him. And we eat, take naps, and then head to the game and everything. So I've known Kenny since I was 12, 13 years old.
That's special. I was basically just going to ask you to talk about your relationship, but now I'm kind of curious, like, are you guys still close today? And do you guys like, exchange sets together? What's that relationship dynamic like today?
Yeah. We, it's funny. We were supposed to, we get together. We both like cigars. So we were supposed to get together Thursday, but something came up on campus. And so we'll connect sometime later this week, but yeah, we talk often, man, and kind of compare notes. He was a head coach before I was, and he was great in giving me just some insights, man. And not just the X's and O's, because that the basketball stuff as a head coach is probably 25% of the job, if not less, you know. But he was able to give me some insight into, you know, fundraising, you know, your relationship with other coaches in the athletic department, you know, your relationship with your AD, you know, all those things, scheduling, recruiting, all those things from a head coach's perspective. So Kenny's been invaluable for me.
Word. You got to patch us in, Coach Ruda and I trying to get him on the pod for sure.
I got you. Consider that done, man.
Say that. Appreciate it. But so after high school, you committed to Maryland. You played 4 years there, three-time all ACC honorable mention. I think you're like eighth in total assists, over 400 assists in your career. I was watching some film of your game back then. I saw your game winner against Georgetown. That was tough. But you also played for, I think, 1 or 2 years with Josh Smith, who was the number one, or Joe Smith, who was the number one pick. So I'm kind of curious if you could just talk about your days at Maryland, but also what it was like playing with a number one pick back then, because I'm assuming like the games were packed. You're getting a lot of like scouts there at some games. The media wants to talk to him all the time. So just talk about like the ACC, Maryland, all that.
Yeah, those are great times, man. You know, I joke right now that the ACC that you see today, that ain't the damn, that's not the real ACC. You know, it is not. And it's, you know, I get it. It's different eras, man. But during that time, I mean, every single night that I played, I was playing against a dude that ended up being, you know, an NBA player, you know, whether it be Randolph Childress, Stephon Marbury, you know, Bobby Hurley, man, Chris Whitney at Clemson, who was very underrated, Travis Best at Georgia Tech. You know, you had to bring your hard hat every game. And I joke with people, I'm like, there's no way in hell during that time that there would be a transfer. This is no disrespect, but there's no way in hell that there would be a transfer from, you know, Radford or Loyola that was going to come and transfer to an ACC school and start and be like a first team all league guy. Like that wasn't happening because the talent level was just way too good. But yeah, when I was at Maryland, man, my freshman year, we were not good. We finished like last.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, like two conference wins or something.
Yeah, yeah. We were, I mean, we had five guys that came into my class, four of the guys with me. We had a five-man freshman class. Maryland was just coming off of probation due to the sanctions from the Lynn Bias death and everything. And we had a reduction in scholarships. We didn't have live TV. We couldn't go to the NCAA tournament. So my first year was the first year that we were off sanctions. And we had good talent, you know, myself, Johnny Rhodes, X-Ree Hip, some of the local guys. But we were babies, you know, playing the ACC. And, you know, we had to get our heads beat in, and we did our freshman year. And then the following year, Keith Booth ended up coming. Keith and I played AAU basketball together, Keith from Baltimore. He ended up being the last pick in the first round after his senior year with the Chicago Bulls. And then we had this guy named Joe Smith that none of us really knew, but we would play pickup basketball from time to time on Sundays. I'm sorry, we would play every Sunday. So Joe committed, and he's on campus. Mind you, the year before, we had a guy named Nemanja Petrovic. He was from Yugoslavia. He was 6'10". He could shoot it, slow-footed, but like he was a modern-day big because he stretched the court and everything. And on paper, coming into the next year, Nemanja was going to be the starting center because we didn't know who Joe Smith was. And the very first Sunday night that we played as a team, I mean, Joe was destroying Nemanja. I mean, just flat out destroying him. And the next day, come in from lifting, and I walk into my suite, and some of my teammates was like, "Yo, you hear about Nemanja?" I'm like, "Nah, he all right? What's going on?" And Nemanja's transferring. Like, within 24 hours, he realized, like, this Joe Smith dude, I'm not playing in front of him. Like, that's how dominant Joe was, man. And Joe made things so much easier for everybody else, man. Like, my freshman year, I shot 20-something percent from three. My sophomore year, and I had to work my ass off. But the next year, because he drew so much attention, it was like, just get a ball to Joe, space out, double team's going to come. Have your hands and feet ready to shoot open threes. And that year I shot like 46% from three or something like that. But Joe was probably the best player that I played with. And consequently, because we were better and Joe brought that with him and everybody grew, you know, like you mentioned, the Georgetown game. That was our very first game of the season, my sophomore year. And Georgetown was top 10 in the country, I think. And we beat them at the buzzer in overtime. And we just kept winning. And before, you could walk into Cole Field House, which is where we played then. You could walk into Cole Field House, man, no matter who we played, and you can get a ticket. And it got to the point where, like, people were camping outside to get into games. And it's like things took a step from there. And, you know, I'm never one to pat myself on the back, but, like, me and my group, I like to say, is we laid the foundation for the success that you see in modern Maryland basketball, I think.
I mean, I honestly wanted to talk more about the Len Bias situation because, you know, I heard you mention in a podcast just overall the effect that, you know, his passing had on the overall DMV. So yeah. If you could speak about that real quick, and then we could talk more about some Maryland basketball I'm kind of interested in.
Yeah, man. I mean, people during that time, no matter what part of the country, if you had seen ACC basketball, you knew Michael Jordan. You also knew Len Bias. And Len Bias to us in this area, I mean, that was our LeBron. That was our MJ. And, you know, the things that he would do, man, on the basketball court, blocking shots, his jump shot shooting over top of people, his alley-oop dunks. Like, it was Georgetown and it was Maryland because it was Len Bias. And, you know, when Len Bias passed away, I literally had met him for the very first time about 2 months before that. And in awe. And when he passed away, man, it was just like, it was like a family member had passed away. And, you know, to this day, everybody that is in the basketball community, if they were around at that point in time, everybody could tell you exactly where they were. It was akin to having a president that was assassinated. You won't forget where you were, 9/11 or whatever. Like, it's not to that degree, obviously, but like how you felt in your heart, it had the same impact.
I mean, he's a community legend at that point, you know, so it definitely makes sense why, you know, it would have a, you know, great impact on you guys, and you guys would feel some type of way. You know, my my dad, like, I remember when I was 9 or 10 years old, and I think there was like a Len Bias, like 30 for 30. My dad's old school, like, he watched like the old Big East and stuff like that.
Yeah. That 30 for 30 came on. I was my wife, she didn't know what was going on, but I broke down crying. Like, I was in tears because it just took me back, man. But like, that was huge for our area.
It's nice. I mean, it's a real story though. Like, my dad showed me, he was like, yo, like, this is like, make sure you keep the main thing, you know, keep it about the right things, focus on, you know, like I'm saying, the right, and stay on the right path. You know, you don't, this is a story for you to hear, you know, as a young man coming up in this world. So,
yeah, I can't tell you, it's a quick side note, I can't tell you how many lives that Len Bias, that whole ordeal, I think that helped, it changed lives and it helped save lives. I can't tell you how many I've been in around some places where it's like, you know, somebody offered coke and I'm like, the first thing I think about is Len Bias. And I was like, absolutely not. Like, not touching it. You know, if I hadn't been exposed to that with Len Bias, would I have said, hey, I'll try it? Who knows? But I know for a fact that I wasn't touching it because of Len Bias.
Seriously. And like I'm saying, like, you know, same thing with me. Like, my dad showed me that. He's like, yo, this is the effects of what, you know, this type of one stuff. Decision. Yeah, one decision.
One bad decision.
Yeah. Change your life. And,
for sure.
You know, on a lighter note, you know, you playing against Georgetown, you representing Maryland, you know, that's a big honor that you have, right? Like, you're coming from the DMV, you played at one of the most legendary high schools in the country of DeMatha. Like, I know KJ asked you about your experience and stuff, but what was that honor like of wearing that Maryland on your chest?
It was huge, man. It was huge. You know, I was recruited. I had offers from all around the country, but I knew I wasn't going to go too far away from home. You know, at the most, maybe going down to Carolina, but I wasn't going to go too far away from home. So to be able to play at home in front of family and friends, you know, my dad was a single parent, and he helped raise me and my dad. So to know that I'll be able to, you know, be 35, 40 minutes away from home and he could catch every game was big for me. And, you know, coming from this area, man, like, John Thompson, my very first team that I like adored was Georgetown because of John Thompson. It was a black coach. The way that they played angry. They played with a chip on their shoulder. You know, back in the day, man, we had these starter jackets. I had my Georgetown starter jacket, Georgetown hat, like everything. But I didn't know it at the time. My high school coach, Morgan Wooten, and John Thompson, they didn't get along. So I had mail and getting recruitment from every single program in the country with the exception of Georgetown. Never got a piece of mail from Georgetown. So everything was etched in stone. I was not going to Georgetown as much as I may have wanted to. But I always also had an affinity for the University of Maryland.
Man, I know that game winner must have felt good then after that.
Man, it made it much easier. Just, you know, I was single and everything. It made it much easier on campus, man.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I watched a podcast that you were on in the game related show. Shout out those guys. You know, they have a great production over there.
They do a great job. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you talked about, and this would be the last question before we go to break, but you talked about finding purpose, basically, you know, after you stopped playing basketball. You know, you had an extra semester at Maryland that you had to finish, and then you were working another job outside of coaching. And, you know, I want you to talk about that time in your life, but what advice you would give to, you know, two young men of color that are trying to make a name for themselves, you know, both in the world with coaching, but just with life in general. Like, I really would love to hear advice.
Yeah. My senior year, spring of my senior year, I withdrew from classes and I was like, I'm going to get ready for the draft and overseas workouts and everything. The dumbest decision that I could have made, because I hadn't got my degree. And when the time did come for me to hang it up, I'm thinking I'm a semester short. I was a communications major. And because 8 or 9 years had passed, the prerequisites for my major had changed. So instead of me needing just two Spanishes, I needed three. Instead of me being done with communications class, I had to go back and take a linguistics class. And like, mind you, this is when, but when I left, there was no internet. And when I get back, we got emails and my first class, and the lights go down and a PowerPoint presentation pops up. I felt like I was like, I just got out of jail and I just came home and everything had completely changed. So that was a lot, man. Yeah. I did not manage my money well. So it wasn't like all I had to do was just take classes and I was good and I had money saved up. Like I had spent money, I had bought a new car, I didn't invest properly. So I'm out here hustling. I'm working at FedEx part-time while also working in the compliance office at the University of Maryland to make a couple of dollars while I'm finishing my degree. And I say all those things to say for those young people, man, like getting your degree is so important. I had some offers to coach in college and in high school. I had a couple of head coaching opportunities that when they found out that I didn't have my degree, they were like, man, we can't hire you. And I was like, well, I'm going to have it done later on down the line. I was like, no, you need to have it right now. So there were a number of opportunities that I missed out on because I did not take care of my business when I was supposed to. So the education is so important, man. Do you have to be a Rhodes Scholar? Do you have to be cum laude? No, you don't. But nonetheless, man, just get it done. Just get it done.
No, that's a fact. I know a lot of people could take that to the heart for sure, but you're kind of throwing shade because I'm on cum laude, so.
Good for you, bro. Good for you. Hey, it wasn't me, man. C's got degrees with me, bro.
Nah, that's a fact. But stay with us while I take a quick break. We are back with Coach Simpkins on the Not Even D2 pod. I know Americans in Washington, D.C., but I was trying to find like some connection that you have to university, and I wasn't really finding any. So first, I'm kind of curious how the opportunity to coach at American came about, but also like you've had a lot of coaching stints at UNC Greensboro, Towson, George Mason. So, and I know that you were like taking notes. I was hearing you talk about you took notes at each stop of like some of the stuff you would do as a head coach if you were in that position, good and bad things. But I'm just kind of curious, like, did you think when you got the opportunity, like, I'm ready to, you know, lead a Division I program? So just talk about like that whole process.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people all the time is I equate it to make the analogies of becoming a parent. You know, I got three kids myself, and, you know, you read the books and you talk to people about what they do and everything, and that shit don't matter until you go through it. You know what I mean? So the same thing with being a head coach. Like, I felt that I was ready some time ago, quite honestly. But not until you're actually in that seat, you know, you just got to go through it. You got to surround yourself with some really good people. People that you trust. You know, my staff is awesome. Guys that I trust, they work their tails off. I think I put myself in a position to be as prepared as I possibly could from doing the extra work. You know, yes, I had my job as being an assistant and recruiting and everything else, but I also had to invest in myself. And, you know, so whenever I could get to a coaching clinic, I would do that. Anytime that I would see some coaches that I thought did a really good job coaching offense, defense on the road, you know, just picking their brain about certain things. It wasn't necessarily to try to position myself to get a job with them, but it was like, hey, I want to try to gain as much knowledge as possible so that A, I can be the best that I can be in my job where I am, but also preparing for if and when that day does come where, you know, God willing, I'm able to get a head coaching job. So, you know, I was able to do that. And having head coaches that you work with, man, the people that you work with is really important. I was blessed to be able to have work with a number of coaches that are damn good at what they do. You know, starting with Pat Scarry, I got a chance to be exposed to Pat. Pat was an assistant coach, a lifelong assistant coach. His first head coaching job was Towson, and our team sucked. Like we were really, really bad. And we won one game. You know, the one game we won, we beat UNC Wilmington, damn game, mate, Sports Center, because We had the longest losing streak in the country. But to see Pat every day, like, grind and recruiting and think about how do we develop, how do we get better, you know, that was important. Then I get the job at UNC Greensboro, and I'm with another first-time head coach in Wes Miller. And seeing him, you know, Wes at the time was the youngest head coach in the country. And right or wrong, Wes felt like he had a lot to prove. And, you know, every day to him was like a damn championship game. It's like, we got to win this. We got to win today. We got to win today. And then to be fortunate enough to work then with Dave Paulson, who had already been a head coach for whatever, 10, 15 years.
That's my guy.
And then another first-time head coach in Kim English. Right? Mm-hmm. So all the accumulation of all of those experiences from all of those coaches who had different stops in their coaching career really helped me, really helped shape my thought process of being an assistant coach, but also what I wanted it to look like as a head coach. And I joke with those guys all the time. Like you mentioned the book, some of the notes that I took, those guys are all in it. There were things that I wanted to take from them. There were some things I was like, I'm not doing that shit. Like, that's not me. You know what I mean? So I think just having those experiences, man, helped shape the and prepare me to be the best coach that I am today. And I'm far from like a great coach, you know, but I think that with the knowledge that I have gained and the experiences that I've had, it puts me on track to really trying to be the, you know, get the most out of my ability.
Yeah, coaches talk often about none of their stuff is original, and you got great mentors that you can take stuff from. So,
I stole some from all of them, absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. But you were in your assistant roles, you were always known as like one of the top assistants in the country, and I know like a lot of assistant roles, the player development aspect is put on their shoulders, but I also know that as a head coach, you're still really involved in the player development. So one, I want to hear what your process is with player development. What are you looking at when you're in a workout? Like, is it their form, their, you know, anything of the little things that you're looking at during a workout? But also, Rude and I have been talking about how a lot of people are moving towards constraint trainings. So like live action stuff instead of, you know, spot shooting or something like that. So I was just curious if you could talk about that too. What you favor, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it all depends on what time of the season that you're in. You know, when we're in season, if we, you know, we call them daily vitamins. If we got 15, 20 minutes with a guy, you know, that workout is going to look different than the workout in April. You know, in April, it is, we have a foundation of who you are. You're not good at, let's say, this left hand hook. Like, I don't want you to experiment during the season with your left hand hook. Now, once we get in April, we're going to work on that. We're going to work on it. We're going to work on it. We're going to work on it in July. And in the preseason, with the hopes that, like, as we now progress, you're ready to shoot your left-hand hook. So the preseason in the spring is when you want to kind of experiment and see what you can do. And same thing in July a little bit. And then in the off-season, you know, the biggest thing, man, is, like, reps at game speed. If there's anything that I'm looking at and I'm really, really going to be honing in on, it's like whatever we do has got to be as hard as you possibly can do it and as quick as you can possibly do it. You know, anybody can shoot spot up threes going half speed and shoot a pretty good clip, but that doesn't happen in the game. You know, we call it 0.5 shooting. Like, you got to catch and get that thing off in 0.5 seconds. For us, the shots that we value, talking about specifically 3-point shooting, if your defender's feet are inside a 3-point line and you are deemed a shooter, and most of our guys are, your job is to shoot the basketball. And so
I love it.
In order to get that shot off, in order to shoot that ball effectively in a game, you have to rep that same pace in the offseason. 0.5 seconds, get it off. 0.5 seconds, get it off. So that's going as hard as you possibly can at game speed. I think that's the paramount, that is the ultimate for me. And then, you know, everything's different, man, for every player. You know, for our guards, all of our guards are going to be involved in ball screens. You know, we'll work on, you know, same-sided games, you know, ball screen action. Like, hey, we're three against two. We got a tag man. He's either going to stay in the corner. All right, you got to hit the roller. Hey, he's going to suck into the roller. You got to be able to throw a good hook pass or reverse pivot pass to the shake guy, the throwback guy. You know, those type of situations. And then, you know, now you got to get creative. You know, if you got a small group, and if it's one thing if it's one-on-one, but if it's a small group and you got six guards, all right, you want the guys to get multiple shots. So after that ball screen action, we throw back. Yeah, you're working on the pass, and now you may pop out for three up at the top of the key. So just using combination shooting and skill work, I think, is really important to kind of confuse the muscles. Anybody can do something over and over and over again. Like, I think that's foundational stuff. But once the foundation is laid, now it's like, hey, how can we confuse your muscles, confuse your brain a little bit, so that now you got to do multiple things all within the same play, because that's what the game of basketball is.
That sounds like great work. I know we asked you to connect with the coach with I know we asked you for a couple of things during this episode, but I might need to see
what else you got, man. What else you got?
The clips from y'all workouts. If y'all got any, I might need to see those.
For sure. Well, yeah, I get that to you. That's no problem.
Bet. It's been a great episode, though, Coach. You know, we really enjoyed, you know, talking to you, and we're going to end it before we got rapid fire and starting five. We're going to end it like this. What's the next step for the American University basketball program, and how do you build on the great success that you had this past year?
You know, obviously, man, going to the tournament was awesome. We hadn't been in there in whatever 14 years or whatever it was. I think for us, it's going back and doing it again. And we got to win a game. You got to win two games. That's the goal. You know, I think, again, it was great. But when a few days after we won and, you know, we come back from the tournament after losing, it's like two or three days had passed and my mind was already turned towards like, all right, how do we build the foundation with the six freshmen that we have coming in so that we can sort the learning curve so that we can put ourselves in position to compete in a non-conference and use a non-conference to help prepare us for Patriot League play so that we can be successful in Patriot League play and do it again. So for us, man, that's what it's all about. And continue to just grow our guys on and off the court. I'm super, super excited about our guys, man. They work their tail off in the classroom. You know, we achieved a 3.3 GPA this past spring. You know, one of the things I'm really proud of is our staff works really hard with our guys on and off the court. And, you know, in the however many semesters plus summer, we've got a cumulative GPA of like 3.35, you know, so our guys are crushing it on the court. They're preparing themselves for life after basketball. And that means a lot to me. We haven't had any knock on wood, any bad issues off the court. You know, our guys have been model, you know, not perfect, right? But they've been model citizens, people that we can look at and say we're proud to represent American University. So between being successful on the court, man, and in the classroom, we want to continue to do that, but even at a higher level.
For sure. Love it, Coach. And definitely expecting big things, you know, out of American University basketball. And yourself, Coach, and we're definitely going to be at some games this upcoming fall and winter. We're excited for it.
Love to have it, man. Love to have it.
Yes, sir. So we're going to end this with some rapid fire before we get into starting five. You ready? You ready, Coach, or not?
I hope so. Go ahead.
All right. So first rapid fire question. What was your favorite ACC like point guard matchup while you were playing?
It's a good one, bro.
I probably have two. Randolph Childress is one. Randolph Childress was at Wake Forest. For guys who don't know, Randolph Childress still has the record for the most points scored in an ACC tournament at like 110, 15, whatever it is. And like Randolph was a bucket. And the way that the ACC was then, whenever we played Wake Forest, every year it was the same. The two or three games leading up to our game was against, they played Duke, they played Carolina, and whoever else. And I remember having to watch film of him destroy Duke, watch film of him destroy Carolina and coming into our game. And I'm like, damn help defense, I'm face guarding him. Like, I'm not letting him get the ball. Like, so it really, I got a kick out of it. He's a DMV dude too, man. So it really made me just like get amped up to try to stop him. And then the other one was Travis Best. Mm-hmm. Travis was a lefty. Travis had the green light at Georgia Tech. Bobby Crimmins, who was the coach at the time, was like, he let his point guards just flat out rock. And Travis Best, like, he would take advantage of it. So, like, being prepared to play against him, man, that got me pumped up as well.
Two great names. I definitely gotta see the film on that, on those matchups.
Oh, pull up the film. Pull up the film. Yeah, you gonna know what I'm talking about.
Bet. Next rapid fire question I got for you. What was the hardest arena? Actually, let's do this. Hardest arena that you had to play in as a college player, and then the other answer or other question I'll ask too is, what's your favorite arena to coach in besides your own now?
The first one, toughest place to play, the Cameron Indoor Stadium, like, fans right on you. It's hot. I don't know if they changed it down there, but like, ain't no damn AC. Like, the locker rooms, they probably turned the heat up in our locker room, knowing them. But like, the environment was so cool, man. Like, and they're there from the very, you come out 90 minutes before the game to shoot around. Like, the students are on the court and everything. So that was always a cool environment. Underrated place. You know, I only played there one time. University of West Virginia. Those folks are rowdy. I don't know if they still do it. They had the little Mountaineer dude. He had the musket gun, and like, he would fire the gun and everything, man. That was my very first road game as a freshman. I will not forget that.
You were shook.
Like, bro, I was on the bench like, yo, what in the world is going on here? Yeah, that was cool. That was a cool environment. I've only played there once. As a coach, Dayton Arena is, if you haven't been to Dayton Arena, bro, like, Dayton Arena is sweet. When I was at George Mason, the first time that I coached there, I walked out, man. It was a Wednesday night, and it was like sleeting outside. I'm like, yo, these fans probably ain't coming out to this. I think they seat almost 14,000. That place was like almost packed 90 minutes before the game, like in sleep. And they know basketball, like, they are into it, man. That's a tremendous environment. Yeah.
Yeah, KJ and I was there. We covered the We Are D3 team. They play in the TBT, and yeah, they were at the Dayton site last year, and when the Red Flyers played, like, we are D3 had a little bit of fans, but when the Red Flyers played, like, the next game, it was completely different atmosphere.
Those folks in Dayton love basketball. They do a hell of a job, really do. Shout out to my guy Coach Grant, man, at Dayton. Love that
Facts.
Dude.
Facts.
Definitely shout out him. And then last rapid fire question I got for you. So Coach Scary and Coach Paulson are two very funny individuals. So I'm wondering, funniest coaches that you've like worked for, and maybe let's do like, name like two coaches, two or three coaches, and then like one player, funniest player you've ever coached.
Damn. Scary was funny, man.
Scary funny.
Scary's funny, man. Like, some of the things he would say, I'm just like, yo, coach, you can't say that.
So, I could picture him saying, like, on a one-win team, him saying, like, you guys aren't good.
Yeah, I can't. Some things I can't say. He won't even say it anymore because it would probably get him fired. But like, he was funny. Paulson had his ways, man, like, just like, but he's a genuinely great dude, but just like, he has some funny stuff. Kim English, Kim would have some stuff. I'm just like, I can't describe it, man. If he would get something in his mind, he wasn't letting it go. And I'm like, bro, like, that's not true anymore. He's like, yeah, it is. That's how I saw it. I'm like, nah, bro, that's not true. But like, all those dudes, man, they had some funny stuff with them. One of the funniest dudes that I coached, damn, probably thinking about, I just talked to him about 3 weeks ago, Jarrell Benjamin, who was a dog. I mean, one of the best players that I've coached. Yes, but transferred to Towson.
Yeah, we were talking about him in an episode. Yeah.
Yeah, the year that I was operations at Towson. And that year, he transferred from Georgetown. He had to sit out at that time. And I can say it now, So NCAA not going to do nothing. But, like, I would work Jarrell out. And, you know, I'm just like, Jarrell would just – I saw his body. He could handle a basketball. He could shoot it. He was a dog. And we would just work on just different things, man. One foot fall-aways and just all kinds of stuff. And he was a tremendous offensive rebounder. And he would piss Scary off because two things. One, he would do stuff offensively, and he was like – and Scary would turn towards me because he knew where it was coming from. Like, Simp, what the hell? Like, what is that? And then he would also dominate practice. He'd be on a scout team, and he would do stuff like get almost every offensive rebound to the point where, like, Scary was like, yo, Jarrell, get off the court. Like, we're trying to get some stuff done here. But, like, he would just destroy the regular team. And sure enough, like, he was a two-time CAA player of the year. Like, he was that dominant, really good. He's funny as hell, too. Funny as hell. This dude got arrested his first weekend on campus after a football game. Like, I'm the operations guy. I get a phone call at like 1 a.m. It's like, yo, do you know Jarrell Benham? I'm like, who is this? And they tell me what happens. I'm like, oh, my gosh. Mind you, this is my first year in college basketball. And I'm like, yo, I'm going back to high school. Don't tell Scary I said this. I told that story, but that was classic.
No, that's funny, but. We got to move to the starting five edition. So if you're a coach assembling a lineup, point guard through center, who's your lineup going to be? And this edition is going to be the best DMV players. And I'll say if you're hip to like every modern DMV players from your time, you could do like all time, or you could just do like during your day. Just tell me where they played at and where they would play in your lineup. If you need a minute too, we could cut it.
No, I'm gonna go down the list here. Golly, mind you, some dudes, obviously some dudes I didn't play with or against. I don't know if you put him at the four to five. Adrian Dantley, Winnie DeMatha, one of the all-time leading scorers in NBA history, was 6'4", 6'5", but he was like a bucket being a center in the NBA, like. Mm. Couldn't stop him. Get to the free throw line. He would be the 4 or 5 in the front court. Danny Ferry. Mm. Danny Ferry was a bad dude in high school. I mean, in college, man, he's one of a handful of guys that won both high school player of the year and NCAA player of the year. You know, number one overall pick with the Clippers at the time. Like, Danny Ferry was a bad dude. Point guard in the DMV. There's a lot of good ones, bro. I mean, you got – if you want to consider Markelle Fultz a point guard, cool. You got Victor Oladipo was kind of a wink, kind of a two-man. Quinn Cook was a bad dude in high school.
Mm-hmm. OD.
But a dude that not people, if you're not from the DMV, you don't really know him. His brother was Charles Smith that played at Georgetown, ended up playing with the Celtics. And he was Big East Player of the Year. But his younger brother named Kurt Smith was a point guard. In the summertime at the pro-ams here, like, he would give pros coming to town 50, 60. Like 5'10", built like a bowling ball, could shoot it, could handle it, had a wicked crossover left to right, right to left. He was so good. He was, you know, he had his challenges and everything, and, like, you know, going to class or what have you. But when he finally got his stuff together, and John Thompson helped the coach at Drake get him to Drake, the 1 year he was there, he made all league, and he was player of the year as a freshman point guard. Like, bad dude. Wings, shooting guards, man. DC area. There's a dude named Henry Radar Hall. They call him Radar because when he stepped over half court, like, he had a radar on the rim. He could shoot that thing from anywhere. And he was another dude that would give dudes fits from the area and from out of town coming in playing a pro-am. Henry Hall. Dude, y'all gonna get me in trouble with this. My DeMatha dude's gonna be like, what about him? Who am I missing? I mean, Kevin Durant. Like,
yeah, I was gonna say, what we doing?
Kevin Durant, Mike Beasley, mm-hmm. all them dudes. Mike Beasley may be the most talented dude pound for pound as a basketball player. Yes, ahead of Kevin Durant and whoever else from the DMV you might want to put out there. Like, basketball savant. Really, really good.
That's just showing how much talent the DMV really got. That's crazy. Because, I, like you said, you're probably missing so many guys. But
oh, yeah. I can't let nobody see this podcast. This is going to be on my head. Yeah.
But that's going to do it for another episode of Not Even D2. We definitely appreciate you getting on. It's been a really good episode. And like Ruta said, we big American fans now and go back to back.
Oh, man, I appreciate you guys, man. Best of luck to you guys in your future endeavors. And if I could ever help with anything here from American University, man, give me a shout.
Appreciate that. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Not Even D2.
Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you follow us on Instagram, Twitter. That's the best way to support the channel.
And all episodes released on iHeartRadio, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's going to do it. And we'll see you next week on Thursday.
Yo, bro, that was a fire episode.
OD.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.